Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, if you listen to David Barsamyan's long-running public affairs program, Alternative Radio, you know his distinctive voice, full of passionate analysis and notable raspiness. But while as host, he always introduces his featured speakers, a who's who of progressive thinkers, we don't normally hear Barsamyan himself at length, as here, where he shares some choice words about our sitting president.
Arguably one of the most dangerous presidents in the history of this country, who is threatening the world with nuclear annihilation, is plummeting the environment, which is a long-term issue that we have to be paying attention to, appointing people to head up government agencies, which are dedicated now to dismantling those agencies.
David Barsamyan says he started Alternative Radio 32 years ago because, quote, corporate media are largely weapons of mass distraction. You can't simply whine and complain. You need to come up with positive alternatives that give people hope. Here, David Barsamyan talks about his new book of interviews with famed linguist, cognitive scientist, and historian Noam Chomsky, Global Discontents, Conversations on the Rising Threats to Democracy. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on February 21st. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
Well, this is my 11th book with Noam Chomsky, this remarkable human being. I don't quite know how to describe him because he has just transcended so many different categories. You know, for quite some time, I understand that in parts of Europe, they thought there were two Noam Chomskys, one this guy that did linguistics at MIT, and this other guy who did politics and was radical and supporting, you know, all kinds of progressive courses. I mean, he is credited with, you know, practically inventing the modern academic discipline of linguistics. He just turned 89. In December, and he's taken up residence in Tucson, Arizona. And people always ask me, well, how did you get in touch with Chomsky? You know, isn't like, you're not into linguistics or anything like that. And I wrote him a letter. I read one of his books around 1980, late 70s, and to my surprise, he wrote back. You know, usually when you write to famous people, that you know, you get a perfunctory kind of response, or this, or a secretary sends a letter, thank you for your interest, have a nice day, sincerely yours. But here was a personal letter, and so we started up a correspondence, and then I suggested, and I'm in Boulder, Colorado at this point, and apprenticing myself at a community radio station there, KGNU, and I was learning how to do radio, so I pitched the idea of doing an interview with Chomsky, and he readily agreed, and that interview was called Politics and Language, and it's been a subject that he and I have both been focusing on for many, many years. As I mentioned, Alternative Radio is going into its 33rd year, and we've had some, I think, spectacular programs of late, if I can say so immodestly, including David K. Johnston on Trump, the Age of Mendacity, Richard Wolff, multiple programs with Richard Wolff, with Edward Herman, who recently passed away, James Stanley, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and many others. So Alternative Radio is a source, and I should also say, acknowledging someone in the audience, Dr. Stephen Bezruchka, who is a local treasure who has been featured on Alternative Radio many, many times. And Dr. Bezruchka is here as well, an ally and a friend. So that first interview actually almost didn't happen with Chomsky because I was technically inept, and I couldn't get the tape recorder to work properly to do this phone interview from Lexington, where he was living at the time. And I said, no, it looks like it's not going to happen. And he was so calm and tranquil about it. He said, no problem. When you figure it out, call me back. And fortunately, I did figure it out fairly quickly, did call him back, and that was our very first interview. Chomsky is not easy to edit precisely because he knows so much and wants to load up all of his answers with as many facts and, tidbits and anecdotes as possible. But I think if you look at the table of contents of Global Discontents, we do cover a lot of ground. And first and foremost is an area that he's long been interested in, and that is the Middle East. And so peeling off the layers of propaganda that have just drenched that particular region and has so distorted U.S. views about Arabs, Muslims, Islam, Palestinians. Chomsky has been a champion for justice and democracy for those peoples and for that part of the world. One chapter is on ISIS, the Kurds, and Turkey. Turkey right now, which is invading Syria, a clear act of aggression, barely commented upon by the U.S. authorities, and that crisis continues to escalate. But I think one thing that Chomsky consistently does is talk about the barrel that produces these distortions and these calamities and these catastrophes, which seem to unfold, time and time again. Why? Asking that particular question. What about the policies that produce these kinds of negative outcomes? And you cannot talk about U.S. foreign policy, I'm sorry, without using the word imperialism. We are an imperial power. We seek to extend our hegemony around the world, controlling resources, and also on that trajectory, controlling human minds. So propaganda is an important part of that process, and no population is more targeted for propaganda than people here in the United States. I mean, Neil Postman, who's written a remarkable book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, says that there's no population on earth that is more misinformed about international issues than people in the United States. You know, I think the bar is pretty high making that kind of statement, but I think there's a good deal of truth there where people have, so little access to independent progressive thought. And, we live in the age of Newsmax and the Drudge Report and Red State and Breitbart News and InfoWars and, of course, Fox, the 24/7 megaphone for the current occupant of the Oval Office. And talking about, propaganda, the essence of propaganda is to win over people's minds to very simplistic ideas and to repeat those ideas over and over again. Do you want some historical background? Read Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. Read Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's propaganda minister. Actually, it was called the Ministry of Popular Enlightenment and Propaganda. That was the official title of Goebbels' ministry. And so you have simplistic slogans repeated over and over again. Build the wall, lock her up, drain the swamp, America first, make America great again, USA, USA. The America first one is really kind of interesting and reveals, again, the total lack of knowledge of history and context. How many of you know that America first was the name of a crypto pro-Nazi fascist movement here in the United States in the 1930s? Just for the radio audience, a handful of hands went up. Yeah, it was led by Charles Lindbergh, who was a great American hero, flew across the Atlantic solo in 1927, a great admirer of Adolf Hitler. He visited Germany in 1938. He admired the Luftwaffe and its accomplishments and warned against the U.S. From entering the war against Germany. So, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And so had someone known that, and brought it to the our own version of Kim Jong-un, then you'll notice I'll try and avoid even mentioning his name. But, we are living in Plato's cave. We see the shadows, but we never know which shadow belongs to whom. And I think that's the great work of Chomsky and what he has contributed to our understanding of what are the root causes of these policies. So we can all feel very virtuous about denouncing anyone old enough to remember George W. Bush, a previous president who we made fun of as, inarticulate and mumbling and, couldn't complete a sentence and that kind of thing. But we don't look at the underlying causes which keeps producing these kinds of political leaders. And the current occupant of the White House is a perfect example of that. And so, to just focus and denounce what is arguably one of the most dangerous presidents in the history of this country, who is threatening the world with nuclear annihilation, is plummeting the environment, which is a long-term issue that we have to be paying attention to, appointing people to head up government agencies, which are dedicated now to dismantling those agencies. So like someone like Scott Pruitt, head of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's more, perhaps should be named the EDA, the Environmental Destruction Agency. And if you'll notice, if you read these scientific reports, and even in the mainstream media, words like unprecedented, record-breaking, and irreparable are being used with such frequency that they've really lost their clout. They've lost their ability to shock, because every day there is a new atrocity, whether it's drilling in the Arctic, whether it's selling off 2 million acres in Utah, the Grand Escalante, and Bear's Ears, and other natural resources. Everything is up for sale. This is a moment of great danger, and we here need to be actively in resistance. And I think, again, this is something that Chomsky urges everyone to do, not just to think about these issues, but to act upon them. This is not a moment for us to be silent Germans, to look away and pretend, well, I was kind of busy and, I was working two jobs and I'm way behind in paying off my daughter's college debt and, and my mother, has just been diagnosed with cancer. I've got, there are all kinds of reasons for you not to get active, but this is a moment where we cannot look away. So I urge whatever you're doing, if you are active in community organizations, to redouble your efforts. And I always think of Pastor Martin Niemöller. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was part of the anti-Nazi resistance. And he was, by the way, a decorated U-boat officer in World War I. After the war, perhaps because of what he saw and what he did, he became a pacifist and a Lutheran minister and part of the anti-Nazi resistance. He was imprisoned at Dachau concentration camp from 1938 to 1945. But he has a kind of famous quotation that starts off with, "First they came for," maybe some of you are familiar with that. Well, I've kind of updated it, to suit our modern situation. So, first they came for the Muslims, and I didn't say anything because I wasn't a Muslim. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't say anything. I wasn't Jewish. Then they came for the trade unionists. Again, I kept quiet. I wasn't involved in trade unions. Then they came for the socialists and the communists. Well, I certainly wasn't part of any of those political parties. And then they came for me, and there was no one left. And so looking away and pretending that the crisis that we're in is not affecting all of us here in this country, here in this city, is, I think, supremely puts us all in a very precarious situation. So in whatever community organizations you have here, peace and justice organizations, 350.org, Code Pink, and I'm sure there are others that I haven't mentioned, getting involved right now is absolutely critical. And there's still time, but time is running short. And again, one of those words, one of those terms that come out in every single scientific paper is tipping point. We have reached a tipping point. We have reached the point of no return. Bill McKibben and others think, you know, we're not quite there yet, but damage is being done to Pachamama. That is very clear. There's an assault on Gaia. There's assault on Mother Nature. You know, if your mother were being assaulted, surely you would rush to her aid. Surely you would come to her defense. That's what's required right now. So I think that issue, as well as the issue of war and peace, become absolutely paramount right now. And Chomsky, of course, you know, talks about the media. In fact, terms like manufacturing consent, although originally not his, was kind of made popular by Noam Chomsky and his late collaborator, Edward Herman, a great, actually, scholar who they both wrote Manufacturing Consent together. This particular T-shirt, and I'll hold it up close to the microphone so the radio audience can see, it says, "Resist Corporate Media." And this comes from a community radio station in Garberville, Redway, California, right in Humboldt County, one of those great community radio stations that we have in this country, like KGNU, which I mentioned in Boulder. You know, and it's kind of curious that Seattle, for all its activism, doesn't really have a genuine community radio station that is community-run, that reflects consistently in its programming progressive issues. This might be something for you to work on here in Seattle. But there is a network around the country, WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, WMNF in Tampa, the Pacifica Network, they have five stations, and other community radio stations that are doing terrific work. And as Chomsky often points out, he notices the difference in terms of the audience's level of knowledge and the sophistication of questions in these communities that have a good, solid, independent media. So resisting corporate media, I think, is certainly part of our job, but creating alternatives is absolutely essential. So it's, you know, it's good to have a critique, but it's also essential for us to present positive alternatives. And again, you know, Chomsky, you know, talking about the media, who like to present themselves as objective, balanced, and free from any bias or agenda. If you believe that, I've got some property, some bridges in Brooklyn I'd love to sell you. Reality suggests something quite different. The media function as a weapon of mass distraction. Much of what passes as news is sometimes subtle, sometimes crude propaganda. The media are large conglomerates that serve to mobilize support for the special interests that dominate state and corporate power. And one of the techniques of the system in perpetuating its own power, of course, is to act as an agent of distraction, to get you focused and others on sports and whether who the Seahawks will draft as number one, can the Mariners get into the playoffs, and the general Kardashianization of a lot of the media, where there's this focus on scandals and Hollywood divorces and getting people's attention away from focusing on the things that are oppressing us and who rules America, who controls the country. And, you know, are we to worry about immigrants and Salvadoran gangs? These are all, again, distractions from the main bout, the main, the main arena of what where our attention should be focused on, and that is imperial power and corporate-controlled predatory capitalism, which is destroying the planet in unprecedented ways. And again, urgent attention is required in these areas. And this happens to be Black History Month. And Angela Davis often quips, you know, we even got the short end of that. You know, it's the one month of the year with 28 days. And today happens to be the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. In a few months, well, on April 4th, to be precise, there'll probably be some recognition that it's the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We just passed his birthday national celebration in mid-January. But it's very curious, again, how the propaganda system works, is how King has been packaged and sanitized, scrubbed clean from his radical proclivities and radical understanding of race, class, and power, and imperial power, and militarism. To this, he's frozen on the footsteps of the Lincoln Memorial on that hot August afternoon with his spectacularly poetic I Have a Dream speech. And it's a great work of very moving and very biblical in its resonance. But the other Dr. Martin Luther King that evolved after that, particularly being influenced by people like Malcolm X, by Stokely Carmichael, by the Black Panthers, by all of the radical movements that were part of the mid and late 60s and early 70s, that Martin Luther King Jr. is largely obscured and cast in the shadows. But we have to listen to that King who is so radical, who called, and if you read his Riverside Church speech, April 4th, 1967, just a year exactly to the date before he was murdered in Memphis, where he had gone to organize a poor people's strike, went to organize the sanitation in support of the sanitation workers who were on strike, and also was about to go to Washington, D.C. to lead the poor people's march, organizing people against the Johnson administration. And he said at the time in New York at Riverside Church, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is the United States of America. He could read this speech today, and every time he says the word Vietnam, if you just insert Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Somalia, Yemen, Mali, Niger, Pakistan, did I leave anything out? All the countries that the U.S. is engaged in militarily, you would not miss a beat because nothing has fundamentally changed. In fact, the violence has increased. So the other day I was giving a talk in Denver. It was the day after the latest massacre in Florida. It got me to thinking about, you know, what are the connections between our government being so violent internationally, deploying troops, having this archipelago of bases everywhere, hundreds of thousands of soldiers stationed in war zones, Africa right now is being greatly targeted by the U.S. military. They're operating in more than 30 countries. This is all happening sub rosa. You know, there's no money for healthcare. Sorry, there's no money to eradicate student loans or provide for free college and university education, as Bernie Sanders was consistently calling for during the 2016 campaign. There's no money for the environment, but there's lots of money for the military-industrial complex. And right here, of course, you're the proud owners, not owners, but you know, you're in the shadow of Boeing here. You're in the shadow of Fort Lewis. There's a bad joke, you know, being made that if Bremerton were an independent state, it would be the fourth or fifth largest nuclear power in the world because of all the Trident submarines with their nuclear weapons. Albuquerque would be third, perhaps, in that listing of, you know, dangerous states. So the military-industrial complex continues unabated, it's accelerated, you know, and of course this is all to make America great again, flag waving, we have to defend ourselves, and of course the manipulation of language and the use of propaganda is how lots of people are persuaded to support someone like the, you know, occupant of the White House. And Alex Carey was an Australian sociologist, not terribly well known in the US, but a friend of Chomsky's. And he said that the 20th century, and I'll just say the 21st century, has been characterized by three developments of great political importance: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy. So when you think about the inequality that exists here in the country, the soaring rates of poverty. Why is that happening? What is it about the American economic slash political system that produces those outcomes? What is the connection between the external violence and the internal violence? I mean, have any of you seen any of these videos, which are very popular with young people? Like, they're called Call of Duty, but there's a whole plethora of them, extremely violent. And I've seen some of the. I've actually sat in on a video parlor once and watched these kids, you know, playing with their. You know, computers, all of these war games, and, you know, becoming anesthetized, kind of becoming comatose to the outcomes that are produced in terms of killing and violence. So it becomes kind of like a game. I remember Lara Logan, who's an overpaid anchor of 60 Minutes, she did a report on the drone base in Nevada. And this was all done in hushed tones. You know, CBS, you know, 60 Minutes has for the first time gotten exclusive access to this base, and we see the base commander and have an exclusive interview with him. I mean, she was totally in awe. You talk about a puff piece, classic kind of sycophancy, which the corporate media, you know, excels in, particularly when it comes to matters dealing with the military. And so there she was, and, you know, following this guy who had zapped what he thought were a couple of targets in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and then going home at the end of the day, and, you know, the kids rushed to the door. Hi, Daddy, how was your day? And, you know, and like everything was just perfectly, you know, wonderful, peachy keen. That kind of, indifference to violence has created an enormously violent country internally and externally. And again, going back to language. They, the designated enemies, you know, you're all to be afraid of Iran, North Korea, Syria. These are all, you know, like powerful states that are, you know, probably waiting for you tonight when you go home. They may even be in your closet. I wouldn't go to sleep if I were you. You know, very dangerous. They attack and invade. We defend. We have leaders. They have hardliners. We live in neighborhoods, they live in strongholds. We have brave men and women in uniform. You hear that phrase just repeated ad nauseum. They have terrorists and militants. They are fierce tribals living by ancient tribal codes. We are civilized. We are representatives of Western civilizations. We have governments. They have regimes. We defend ourselves honorably. They ambush. They use snipers. They conduct sneak attacks. They use human shields. We carry out surgical strikes. Just tell that to all of the Afghans and Pakistanis and Iraqis who have had their homes targeted by drone attacks, wedding parties, mosques, madrasas, which are seminaries, Muslim seminaries, time and time again. Those stories, if they're reported on at all, and now they've become so common that they barely, unless they hit some high number, barely get any media attention at all, buried deep inside the newspapers and magazines. This reflects, I think, also the racism which is inherent in any imperial policy, which Chomsky talks about quite a bit as well, to denigrate, to have worthy and unworthy victims. So you learn all, if an American soldier is killed somewhere on many of these battlefronts, whether it's in Niger or in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq, you learn all about this person, what his goals were, his family life, the interview with, you know, his high school teacher. They become human beings. You identify with them. But who cares about Mumtaz Mahal? Who cares about Wazir Muhammad? Who talks about Akhtari Begum? Those people become invisible. They have no lives. They have no context. And that racism, of course, is so deeply rooted in U.S. culture, in the foundation of U.S. culture, with the destruction of the indigenous population, with the introduction of African Americans as slaves, and with the ongoing racism, which has now blossomed, if I could use that term, because it's been given an imprimatur, it's been enabled by a White House that is now turning these tropes of propaganda against one another, against all of us, dividing the society. We are to be afraid of this and that group that is, you know, threatening us. Fear, of course, is exactly playing into the hands of any demagogue. War crimes and war criminals, certainly a topic that Chomsky talks a great deal about, but international law does not apply to the empire. We are exempt from not just moral law, but from international law. So take the case now, again, with Iran. Some years ago, I wrote a book called Targeting Iran, and we talk a lot about Iran in this book. Iran is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Trump administration, I said the name, but I qualified it with administration. The White House seeks to withdraw from this agreement that the U.S. signed with the other members of the Security Council, as well as Germany. So it's known as the P5, the Security Council members and Germany. So this is how the leader makes America first, withdrawing from the Iran deal, withdrawing from the Paris Accords, defying international law and the overwhelming majority of public as well as official opinion around the world, and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, in total defiance of international law. But again, international law applies to others. We are exempt. That is a classic technique of imperialism. And, you know, Iran is now, I'm afraid, being targeted again for a possible military attack. We've had these show and tell, kind of demonstrations with Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, you know, holding up a piece of metal purportedly to be an Iranian piece of an Iranian missile. I mean, don't these people have any memory of Colin Powell in 2003 at the UN, you know, showing this, this, and that, and this is all proof of Saddam Hussein being, having weapons of mass destruction. And Benjamin Netanyahu, another, you know, wonderful, enlightened leader who is under criminal investigation in Israel, also held up a piece of metal the other day saying, you know, this is proof positive of Iranian perfidy. You notice that when in the media reports, Iran is always accused of meddling and interfering in the affairs of the Middle East. Where is Iran located, by the way? This is a geography question for Americans. Is it somewhere in between Bolivia and Paraguay? And where is the United States located, where it has all of these bases in this region, where it conducts coup d'etats, where it overthrows certain regimes and supports other extremely reactionary regimes like Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, the great leader's, you know, favorite country, the first country that he went to visit, by the way. You remember he did that little saber dance? I mean, you're talking about one of the most extreme regimes anywhere in the world, kind of the epicenter of misogyny and patriarchy, and a particularly pernicious form of Islam known as Wahhabism, named after Muhammad Wahhab, who was a 17th century, there was no Saudi state then, but a Saudi cleric. And this was the, you know, the same Wahhabism that was exported with U.S. blessings to Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 1980s. Those of you old enough to remember Ronald Reagan praising these homicidal maniacs and drug traffickers, that is the Afghan Mujahideen, as freedom fighters, as the moral equivalent of the founding fathers. These are the allies that Washington consistently makes with, you know, these characters around the world and supporting dictatorships in Egypt, first with Mubarak, now totally embracing Sisi in Egypt, and on and on. We need a democratic foreign policy that is rooted in law and justice and not an imperial aggressive military policy which is fueling the jihad. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, put yourself in Osama bin Laden's head if you can for a moment. What can I do to bog down the U.S. in multiple wars, across mostly the Muslim Middle East, mostly Arab countries? And to produce that outcome, you know, I think was, you know, the attack on 9/11. And the U.S. fell right into the trap, has basically expanded the so-called war on terror. Now in its, by the way, 17th year, I lectured to junior high school and high school students, and I look out at the audience, and that's all they've known. They've known the United States at war. That's the background soundtrack. That's the white noise that is given off by the lights here, for example, and it continues on and on. Meanwhile, back at home, we don't have, you know, look at our transportation system, look at all the things that we desperately need to attend here, but the military pulls away so much of the money. And who profits? We the people? Well, you know, there may be people in this audience that work for Boeing and make, you know, a very handsome salary. But, you know, the military-industrial complex profits Northrop Grumman and its stockholders and its executives and Lockheed Martin and Boeing and United Technologies and Raytheon and General Dynamics and General Electric and all the other military contractors that are making money hand over fist. There's almost an institutional imperative to foment conflict around the world, because You can sell more weapons, more conflict, use the weapons. You need upgrades. Now the U.S. is flogging the F-35, the most expensive airplane ever built. We now have Ford-class aircraft carriers coming in at $13 billion a pop. Zumwalt-class destroyers, stealth destroyers. There's not even a discussion about this anywhere in the media about these overpriced, useless weapons of mass destruction. The Zumwalt-class destroyers are costing $4.2 billion a pop, and there are two or three more, you know, on the design board that will be produced in the next few years. Again, where is the money for our people? Where is the money for education, for health, for the environment, for mass transportation? I mean, there's been a whole series of catastrophes with Amtrak, with our so-called railroad, I'm hesitant to use the term network, whatever it's called, the train systems here that need a tremendous amount of upgrading. No money for there, plenty of money for the imperial war machine. Now, getting back to Iran and the Iran deal, and this is something that Chomsky talks about in great detail, there was a problem with the deal. Let's be honest about it. What was the problem? It was working. Iran was in total compliance with the conditions of the accord. It's not a treaty because it wasn't ratified by Congress. It was an accord, an agreement, you know, much like the much vaunted Oslo Accords, which accorded the Palestinians oblivion in their struggle for justice and peace. Nikki Haley was dispatched, again, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. She was sent to Vienna, which is where the IAEA is headquartered. That is the International Atomic Energy Agency. That's the agency that monitors those states that are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, of which Iran is a signatory, and the U.S. is a signatory as well. They send out inspection teams. She was sent there specifically by the great leader to find dirt on Iran. Well, they must be cheating. They must be developing centrifuges under their Nunvai, you know, which is an Iranian bakery, you know. So while they're making sangek on the street here, underneath there's, you know, all of this skullduggery going on. You can't trust them after all. You know, they're Orientals and they're Muslims, or Muslims as they're called in the media, or Muslims, even worse. And she came back empty-handed. She couldn't find anything. The UN, the IAEA, sent not one, not two, not three, but eight inspections to Iran to look at what they were doing. And they found Iran in total compliance. And then Haley came back to New York, you know, kind of shamefully disgraced, if that's even possible. It's interesting that she's being touted by such great intellects as Bill Kristol, a neocon who is now kind of critical of the great leader, as a possible presidential candidate in 2020. Horrors continue. You know, maybe we should practice saying President Pence. You know, you have to be careful what you wish for. Here you have an American Taliban, a fundamentalist Christian whose misogyny is over the top, whose patriarchy is over the top, and you know that's what's right behind the great leader. So you know, there's no disguising the fact. I mean, we are in a pickle. We are in a very serious crisis, something I haven't seen since the late '60s, when Nixon was running amok. But looking back on some of the things that Nixon did, perhaps Chomsky is right. He was the last liberal president. You know, we have Earth Day, the Clean Water Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air Act. All of these, the expansion of national parks, all of these, at least domestic issues, were carried out by Richard M. Nixon. Of course, internationally, he was an out of control homicidal maniac, given to fits of drinking and wild attacks on Jewish people, which the great Henry Kissinger, Nobel Peace Prize winner, never uttered a word while Nixon was carrying on about Jews and how they controlled everything and wanted, you know, only the worst for him. But we, you know, to get back to now the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, there are certain states that are not signatories to this treaty. The U.S., which is, by the way, is in violation of this treaty because it calls for the gradual reduction of nuclear weapons. So what is the great leader proposing now, following in Obama's footsteps? A huge expansion, $1 trillion plus expansion of smart nukes, of usable nukes. These are weapons that cannot be used. These are Armageddon weapons. So what are they thinking? So the U.S. is in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. U.S. allies, India, Israel, and Pakistan, a quasi-ally, but let's say an ally, are all non-signatories to the NPT, but there's not a word about them. And they all have, not only do they have nuclear weapons, they have ballistic missiles to deliver those weapons. They have, you know, very highly developed programs of mass destruction. But we're not holding them to account because when you're on the side of the empire, that is to say Washington, you get a permanent get-out-of-jail pass. So again, to come back, you know, to what we need to do, we need to get off of Facebook and into the face of these politicians, be they your local legislator, your council people, your senators, whoever it might be, make as much noise as possible. Stop tweeting and get into the streets. That's the kind of activism that the times demand. It's not a time for gentle contemplation. Okay, you know, please do read poetry. Please do. Don't ignore the arts. Arts are very important, but we have to get more involved politically and not wait, you know, carry out this waiting game. And I love Rebecca Solnit, a very thoughtful writer. She says, an optimist thinks everything will be fine no matter what, and that justifies doing nothing. But hopefulness means that we don't know what's going to happen, and in that uncertainty, there is room to act. So there's still room out there for citizen intervention. There's still room for us to inject our energy. You know, like Gramsci, the great Italian Marxist, he used to say that, you know, this seems to be a monolith, this wall. But if you look closely, there are cracks there. And in every space, you can pour in energy and widen those cracks. Leonard Cohen actually has a song that speaks exactly to that particular thing. He's a great musician and artist. I might even have that song quote here. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. So we have to, you know, be very skillful. Be like Muhammad Ali advises. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. You know, and so that's, you know, that we need that agility and nimbleness right now. And we need to create alliances. I know we're all on the, you know, the left here. We're progressive. You know, we're holier than thou. We're very virtuous. You know, but we also have a history of being very exclusionary. And that, I think, historically has been one of the reasons. There are other reasons, indeed, the right-wing attack and assault on the left and progressives. But internally, we've too much emphasized political purity. Oh, you voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary? I can't talk to you. You eat meat? Oh, horrible. You're not a vegan? What? Can't talk to you. You know, again, it's like that Pastor Niemöller thing. Pretty soon, there's nobody left. You know, so we have to be more ecumenical, more embracing, and find common ground. Do we agree we have a major crisis in this country? Is the planet is under assault. It's being plummeted. Are we going to do something about it? Those are areas, and I find this even with right-wing audiences when you talk about, for example, food. Do you want your kid, or do you want to eat nutritious, wholesome food? Or would you prefer food laden with GMOs and additives and preservatives and artificial dyes and who knows what other chemicals? I mean, the answer is a no-brainer. Everyone says, of course I want my kid to have nutritious food. Of course I want my kid to go to parks that are well-maintained and clean and breathe clean air and drink clean water. These are areas where are openings. There are apertures that we should, you know, pour our energy in and then expand the conversation into other areas of predatory capitalism and imperialism. But internally, we have had, we, if I can use collectively, have had a history of being too intolerant of, you know, others and not embracing. You know, we want people to be somewhere. I want everyone to know who Noam Chomsky and has read all of his books. I want people to know about Antonio Gramsci and what he's contributed terms in political thought. But most people are not there. So we have to be realistic and not be holier than thou, not lecturing people. Again, a prominent, I hope I'm not doing that this evening. You know, a prominent kind of a leftist characteristic, you know, I know everything, you know nothing, listen to me. You know, I may feel good, you know, saying those kinds of things, but that's not going to invite you, that's not going to bring you into any kind of circle where we can have a conversation. So, you know, expanding those areas of conversation are, you know, absolutely critical.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. David Barsamyan spoke about his new book of interviews with Noam Chomsky, Global Discontents, Conversations on the Rising Threats to Democracy. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on February 21st. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Stay current with us by subscribing to our podcast. We appreciate your likes and comments. Tune in again soon.